This is our league, and this is your league. From the 55-yard line on CFL America Radio and the Sports History Network.
Do you know me? I play an important position on the Los Angeles Rams. I own them, and that's a big financial responsibility. That's why I carry the American Express card. After all, I don't just watch the offensive line and the defensive line. I have to watch the bottom line.
To apply for a card, look for this display wherever the card is welcomed.
The American Express card! Don't leave home without it! Yeah!
This is a league of A's and BCs. It's green and red and gold and black and blue. This is a league with two official languages and many unofficial languages. It's East versus West, wheat versus iron, love versus hate. This is a league where superstars are extraordinary and ordinary at the same time. It's a league of ice, of fog, of mud, and wind. And for one Sunday in November, it's the nation's glue. This is a league as diverse as a country, a league of Jacksons and Kwongs, Johnsons, Moscas, O'Shea's, and Haji Razulis. This is his league, her league, and their league. It's my league, and it's your league. This is our league.
From the 55-yard line, it's Scott and Greg, and today we are joined by retired New York firefighter, Vietnam veteran, and 9/11 first responder, Billy O'Connor, and television producer, four-time Emmy nominee, Frank Pace, who also worked in public relations back in the 70s with the Southern California Sun, Portland Storm, the Chicago Winds of the World Football League. Billy and Frank are the co-authors of the new book, Lamar's Gamble, a tale of the AFL-NFL merger, and join us both via the internet from Los Angeles. Special thanks, shout out to our mutual friend, Upton Bell, for his connecting us and allowing us to make your acquaintance and letting us know about your great book. So welcome to Sports History Network, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
And Scott and I, we both got copies of your book and we read them. And the great thing about football and football history and football books is doing these podcasts is now I'm allowed to not that long ago, you really didn't have people to talk to about this stuff, but with podcasts, now everybody can talk to everybody about their favorite subject. And for Scott and I, we are big football history buffs. Obviously we're Canadian football podcasts too, big CFL buffs, but the AFL and the time period that you guys wrote about is for both of us amongst probably one of the more fascinating chapters in professional football history. And if I could start out, where did the genesis of the book come from?
I'll let Billy answer that because the answer to that's going to be a bar in the Bronx. So Billy can pick up the story from there.
Most of my stories always start in the bar of the Bronx. You know, William Patrick Michael O'Connor from County Cork, Ireland. It's not too much of a suspension of disbelief to think there might be bars involved with my life. But when I came back from Nam, I was 22, and of course, the 60s, you know, was, and the big Jet upset over the Colts was a big deal, you know, because I was a New Yorker in Nam, and when I came back, there was a guy I went to school with, grammar school, actually, his name was Neil Blank, and his uncle was Art Donovan, who played guard on the Colts, and he wrote a book himself, Art Donovan, called Fatso. He did big tour, all the talk shows, used to be on Johnny Carson all the time. He was a bit of a character. Anyway, I went to the same grammar school, same high school that Art Donovan went to. So his nephew, Joe Blank, says to me, "Hey, Billy, how'd you like to meet my Uncle Artie?" It's like 11 o'clock on a Saturday morning. I said, "What, are you kidding me? Art Donovan? Yeah, of course. I'd love to meet Art Donovan." So I trek the five blocks up to this bar, the Idle Hour, and I walk in, and there's maybe three guys in the bar. And Art Donovan is sitting there. We used to get these 15-cent, 7-ounce drafts in a day. You know, they were like little Pilsner glasses. And he had his hand around his Pilsner glass, and it looked like a shot glass. I mean, it actually disappeared. And he was ranting. He was saying, are you kidding me? Let me tell you something. He says, something wasn't on the level of that game. He goes, I'm telling you, Rosenblum gave Eubank our playbook. He goes, no way that we could have lost that game to the Jets. Couldn't happen in a million years. No way. And I was thinking, you know, Jesus, great to see Art Donovan. But this is just a cranky old man, you know, sour grapes, you know. And it just put that in my head. And then I started reading, do a little research, and not really research, just curious. And I read Bubba Smith wrote a book about how he didn't think the game was on the level, that something was rotten with the game. And then I read a couple of more books, like Bernie Parrish had written a book. I went to the University of Florida at a late age, and Parrish played at the University of Florida, later played for the Cleveland Browns. And he had said that in his book, They Call It a Game, that he had played in at least five games that he knew weren't on the level. There was something wrong with the game. And he said, thanks, that one, a Super Bowl was fixed. And that really got me thinking. And I started doing some more research. I started reading some more books. This guy, Benny Moldea, wrote a book called Interference. And he claims that the book wasn't on, that the game wasn't on the level. So anyway, that just started the genesis. And you guys are history buffs, and I'm a big history buff. What I like about our book, Lamar's Gamble, it's not a book totally about football. It's really a book about a reflection of history through football. As Frank will tell you, like we talk about many times about how the heavyweight championships of boxing, if you look at it, it's almost a reflection of history in America. You look at the early champs, Sullivan, Corbett, Fitzsimmons, all those guys were champs when the Irish were having a hard time of it in America. And then later on, you look at the blacks in America with Joe Louis, and they have champs in them days. And the Italians with Graziano and Marciano. And then onwards right into Latin Americans of today. And you can sometimes sports can be a window in history. And I like to think our book reflects that.
See that? There's about 90 minutes gone right away. We'll be back next week with another exciting chapter from the 55-yard line.
Well, it was nice talking for you guys. Yeah.
makes our job easy, that's for sure.
Lark Flyman used to tell me that all the time. Let O'Connor say a few thousand syllables. O'Connor, get over here and say a few thousand syllables. Yeah, I'm a blabbermouth. Sorry.
No, when you guys got together and decided to do this book, was it always the idea to make it, as you call it, a work of faction, or was there ever a time where you we're just going to go ahead and play it straight and kind of present the history of the rivalry?
Well, we couldn't actually. We stayed true to the facts about 80%. All the football stuff is fact-based. All of the bedroom stuff and the boardroom stuff, we had to invent dialogue because we weren't there. Although once we later found out that Upton was there. So...
Yeah, and he might have been in bed with him too.
Yeah, it gave us a little bit more credibility. So we went from 80% facts to 85-90% facts. But we stayed true to the facts and all of the football related stuff. We just, you know, sort of invented, like Spielberg did in Lincoln, the bedroom conversations and the boardroom conversations.
Exactly. Gore Vidal made a living out of that. You know, when he wrote Lincoln and he wrote Burr, I'm always fascinated by the way he writes. I think he's a terrific writer. He wrote history and he wrote dialogue. Obviously, he couldn't be in bed with Mr. and Mrs. Lincoln. But the books that I told you about before that I had read about the history of the AFL and the NFL merger and about the gambling and everything else started to read like Wikipedia after a while. Right. I don't think our books are like that. It's very entertaining because of the dialogue. And the dialogue has a purpose. It's leading to tell the story, you know, but you don't have to tell the story in a Wikipedia style. You can tell it where it's interesting. I think we did that. And I think the quotes that we did take from the people of that era, and I'm talking, you know, Muhammad Ali, Joe Namath, fascinating people, Cosell, they're matter of public record. We just took the quotes that we thought were entertaining, you know?
Well, one thing I talked to Greg about earlier this afternoon, we were discussing the book is, you know, I'm a Jets fan and I've always enjoyed the history of the, you know, the Titans of New York and everything. And then when I read the way you guys wrote Harry Wismer, that's exactly as I thought he might have been. I mean, when I'm reading that, I could imagine everything that he said in your book was what I could imagine him actually saying in life. I mean, I thought that was just a great characterization of him.
Yeah, we tried to stay true to character. You know, we didn't want Carol Rosenblum to say, "Gosh darn golly, Lamar, why are you doing this? Fuck you, Lamar. Why are you?" So we tried to stay true to character, and you know, it's sort of like, you know, when we say faction, you know, everybody accepts Lin-Manuel Miranda's portrayal of Hamilton. Well, there was nobody in those days that talked hip hop, and he wrote a whole musical about that. So I think we stayed pretty true to the characters as they would have been in reality.
Yeah, and you know, when I first, even though it says Lamar's Gamble, it's not about Lamar. There's, to me, the major character of your book was Carol Rosenblum. And in reading the history of the Colts and reading the history of the NFL, he's ever present during those 50s and the 60s and obviously the 70s up until his death in, you know, in the water off the coast of L.A.
Florida.
Was it Florida? I'm sorry. No worries. It's water either way. Yeah.
That's a heck of a float from Florida to LA, though, that's for sure.
But the Carol Rosenblum and other stuff I've read, I never got a good feel of him. But with your book, I understand, at least I feel now as I move forward reading other books in football history about the Colts, about the Rams, I have more of a feel of who Carol Rosenblum was. And to me that was the takeaway from the book. To get a better feel of who these people were in history and in sports history.
That's interesting that you mentioned that, because the first time we wrote the book, again, Billy, I never know the difference between antagonists and protagonists. So I want to say the first time we wrote the book, it was Carol Rosenblum's book. And then we went through and we rewrote it and we made it Lamar's Gamble. Because Lamar was really a more central character to that merger. And we figured if Lamar could be the antagonist.
Protagonist.
Right. If Lamar could be the protagonist, we could do more with that. And we made Carol Rosenblum a character being 1A and Georgia would be 1B.
Exactly. Like he became the antagonist because he's trying to thwart Lamar at every turn, you know? So Lamar has his vision. He's got this dream and he's not going to be deterred. But as far as the characters, you said you got a good feel for Carol Rosenblum. Frank and I probably read about 15 books about the AFL-NFL merger. And 90% of what we say in that book has been quoted, requoted, and double-checked and rechecked again. So you should get a good feel for Lamar, for Carol, and for Georgia. Because, and Upton, if anything, when Upton did our podcast, he sort of verified the way we felt about all three guys. And Carol Rosenblum and Lamar Hunt were very complex characters. You don't get to be powerful without being complex.
And then also, you know, Harry Wismer, like you said, Ralph Wilson, Al Davis, Pete Rozelle, all of those are very... fully formed characters, we feel, and we think you learn a lot about them in this book.
Yeah, even with the Kennedys.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you said that, because I think I'm proud of the book. I'm proud of the way we wrote about the merger, but I'm also proud of the way we link it to history, because Frank and I have talked about this many times. There's no way that merger could have taken place had it not been for the time that we're doing. That was going on in the 60s, the turbulence of the 60s, the contrast between the Giants locker room. And I was a big Giant fan when I was a kid. I became a Jet fan in the 60s because of Namath, because of the contrast of, you know, the Giant locker room with the crew cuts and the ties and the collars. And then, of course, Namath comes out with the fur, the long hair, the music in the Jet locker room as opposed to the music in the Giant locker room. I mean, just the contrast and the tumultuous times of the Vietnam War. and civil rights and all that was going on in the 60s. And we give you a window into that period. You don't have to be a history buff to enjoy the historical part of the book.
But there is so much great history, and even things that I'd forgotten about, like mentioning the 1952 NFL Dallas franchise. I'd completely forgotten they had that. But I mean, you know, weaving in how that kind of played into everything with Lamar Hunt. I mean, it was just so interesting because, yeah, I mean, by the time you're done with the book, you know these guys. I mean, we knew of them before through, you know, as you mentioned, like Wikipedia accounts of the leagues. But now you actually knew the person, and that's very important, especially for historians, you know, to get a grasp of who these people were.
Well, this book is so well researched that we could have written this book 25 years ago because there was no internet. So whenever we had a question, Billy or I would just, a historical question, we would ask Siri or whoever, and three or four or five sites would pop up, and that would refer us to other sites. So we really could read a multitude of sources before we made a decision on which way to go with the story.
Was there any character in particular that was the toughest to write? I mean, maybe someone that you just didn't find a lot of information on, so you had to sort of just assume what they were like?
Well, I'll answer that one. I would guess it was a little bit Lamar, because Lamar was the least colorful. Lamar was the least colorful, most bland character in the world. And second would be Ralph Wilson, because Ralph Wilson was the second least colorful, most bland person in the world. And it was easy to write about Al Davis. It was easy to write about Pete Rozelle. It was easy to write about Carol or Art Modell or Rooney. Lamar, we had to do research for, and we had to dig deep to find the truth behind the story. And I think we did a good job on that.
Yeah, I think when Rosa Bloom asked Tex Stram, and he said, what do you know about this guy, Lamar Hunt? And he said, you'd have trouble picking him out of a crowd of three, pretty much sums up. He was a pretty colorless guy, you know. But not to be underestimated, he had a fierce determination. And his father was the richest man in the world. So that kind of helps.
Yeah, you're right. And that's what the reading about him, because now you get a feel with your book what, you know, Hunt Sr. was like. Because in all the history books I've read, never got a feel other than he was a rich oil man. But in this one, you get a feel of him as a human being rather than just some stoic. I mean, there's a lot of human connection with all of the characters in here that you don't get from other books on the time period.
Well, that's a great compliment, me and Frank. That makes me feel real good. I think the most important thing of any book, when you read the first page, is to make you want to read the second page. It has to be entertaining, you know, and first and foremost, if it's not entertaining, who's going to read it? I mean, you could divulge who killed Kennedy on the 40th page, but if they're not going to get to the full page unless the first 39 are good. It's that simple. I mean, it's just too many different things plying for your attention, too many different media forms plying for your attention. So in this day and age, in an age of Twitter and texting and bumper sticker wisdom, you better grab their attention to keep it, because you only got one chance. And I'm delighted you guys found that it was entertaining and interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I got, even though I'm a history buff, the history part of it, what to me was, you know, almost kind of, you know, the sports kind of took a back seat to the history that was being played out on the pages, because you got an inside feel of what the Kennedys were really like. And to me, the one character that I knew very little about was Georgia. Tell me about her. What was, when you guys were writing Georgia, where did you guys draw the inspiration? I mean, was it press? Was it from friends? Was it from acquaintances? I know you guys are both out in LA. So where did you have people who knew her to help along and with the writing process?
Well, I think that from our standpoint, Georgia sort of wrote herself. we had a lot of background information on Georgia and there were actually two Georgias. There was a Georgia from the age of 21 to 29, where she was married five times. And there was the Georgia who became secure after Carol divorced his wife and married Georgia. And she became more legitimate after that. I think Georgia was, Carol was Georgia's sixth husband. And by that time she knew she had gotten it right with Carol. But I think the groundwork was laid in her early years when she was a bit of a girl, to say it nicely. And that sort of colored her life and her as it got older. She never, I think in her mind, she never really escaped her upbringing.
Yeah, she had a very insecure childhood, as you read in the book. And I mean, she rose to become the most powerful woman in football. That was a hell of an ascent. And it doesn't really matter how you got there. She got there. And, you know, she was a butt of a lot of jokes. There was bumper stickers in L.A. for a long time. You know, honk if you've been married to Georgia. Which, you know, it was a determined woman. And again, like Lamar, I don't think you can become a powerful person unless you're determined and relentless. And she was willing to do whatever it took. And I hope the book showed that.
Well, it absolutely did. You know, one thing that was really interesting to me, and you guys touched on it a couple of minutes ago, you have Lamar Hunt, who's a boring guy, and yet he's spearheading the renegade league that's going against the establishment. And the whole time I'm reading that, I'm thinking, wow, does he even know what he's doing here? Obviously he did, because it worked, but it is kind of funny to have a guy like that, you know, a little sort of nebbish kind of person who's running the show, basically.
Yeah, and his best friend was Bud Adams. And Bud was a brash, full of shit guy. And he would stick it in anybody's face. So he did, you know, he did a lot of Lamar's dirty work on behalf of the duo.
Yeah, he was the total opposite. He was an ostentatious character, a larger life. Even by the way he dressed, the way he acted, the money he had, of course, he was in the oil business as well. But Lamar, there was a famous show back in the 50s, early television, called Mr. Peepers. And the head of the star of Mr. Peepers was Wally Cox. And he was a Don Knotts type character, very timid, glasses, nerdy. And many people compared Lamar to Wally Cox, you know.
He was underdog.
Hey, let me ask you a question. We've talked about the book a lot. Do you have any idea where you can find it? Maybe a Mick a move and a fight.
Well, that's, you know, I apologize. I did not mention your podcast and your YouTube show when we started off. You guys, you know, we'll set the book aside here. Well, let's talk about your podcast. You guys, how long have you been doing the podcast and the show?
A year this week.
Awesome. Happy anniversary.
There, partner. Happy anniversary.
Yeah, happy anniversary to you too. I'm glad you're away, because you probably kiss me. This week is today was actually the first episode of the new season. We've got Wendy Selig-Preeb, who was the CEO of the Milwaukee Brewers, first CEO in Major League Baseball, and her husband Laurel Preeb, a longtime Major League Baseball executive, on the podcast. And our website for the podcast is www.amic.com. And you can see all 52 of podcasts right there. And on upcoming weeks, we've got Rob Nelson coming on from Big League Chew. We've got Leslie Visser coming on from the NFL and Major League Baseball. We've got a mixed martial arts expert on the way. We've got Adrian Barbeau upcoming.
Oh, really? So, ooh, yeah, so there we go.
Oh, yeah.
The Fog.
Guests. And no. Richie Picciotti.
Richie Picciotto from, he wrote a book called Last Man Down. He was one of the survivors of 9/11. He was inside the building when the building collapsed around him. But we've been very fortunate with our guests. And I always break Frank's chops, because that's what we do. You know, we're Yorkers and originally, and I always call him Frankie the Juice, because we've had some great guests. We've had Artis Gilmore on.
Chicago Bull.
Yeah, terrific. And Tony O, who's Frank Sinatra's road manager. We're going to have him on again. Stephen Lang, the actor, Avatar.
Cowboy Joe West.
Cowboy Joe West. We just had some, it's a real kick for me because most of these are friends of Frank's and I'm just a broken down old fireman. What do I know? But I'm getting to meet a lot of really fascinating people, you know, from Pulitzer Prize winning columnists. It's just a real kick for me, you know, really. I'm having a lot of fun doing this.
Well, that's, you know, that's why Scott and I started the podcast here because, you know, being able to talk to people. The great thing about living in the 21st century is the internet has allowed us literally to connect with everybody. For all the bad it's done in the recent years, I think we can all agree, the one thing it allows us all to do is really connect. And when you know, the great thing about sports and entertainment is it cuts through all the politics. It cuts through all the divisiveness. And is what have you guys found the most rewarding with doing the podcast?
Well, I already answered my part.
Oh, yeah, you did.
I did. I just meeting all these wonderful, fascinating people, you know, and I'll let Frank take it from there.
I think, even though I'm still working at Warner Brothers, I think that allows me to keep my mind active. I keep learning new things. And Billy, are you blowing smoke?
I've been blowing smoke all my life, pal. All my life. It's got me this far.
You're vaping as we're speaking. allows me to keep involved in the things that I've in really inspire me. And again, I'm sort of reliving my life and introducing my life to Billy. And because Billy and I never really wanted to do a podcast. We were just two guys writing a book together. And our third guy in the booth, Derek Harris, whose daughter coached in soccer, said, why don't you do a podcast? I said, well, I never done a podcast, but you know, he said, well, you and Billy would be great. And then I sort of flashed upon Gracie Allen and George Burns. And I figured I could be George Burns and say, tell me about Uncle Charlie, Gracie. He says he's talking about 39 years. So I figured I could get through that. I said, okay, but just I really don't want to do anything other than be a host. So Derek, you have to do everything else. So the end credits have Derek listed at 25 times in every category. Because really, without Derek, I say we couldn't have done this. But this was such a great partnership. Without any of the three, it wouldn't survive.
Right. Yeah. You know, and that's kind of how Scott and I are. I mean, we both work in the controls in the background. You know, from setting up the interviews to, you know, only one of us can click the record button, and that's myself.
There's an old adage, they say, if you and your partner agree on everything, if you and your partner have the same talents, then one is unnecessary.
And the great thing is, you know, Scott and I, we split the profits 50-50. 50% of zero is zero.
like Billy and myself.
Oh, yeah.
We don't split the expenses. We split the profits.
Right, right. It's
a good thing we don't split the expenses.
And you know, in terms of with sports and everything, are you guys both now, Billy, you still a Giants or a Jets fan? Where are you at?
You know what? I'm one of the few guys that are both Giants and Jet fans. If you live in New York, if you're a Giant fan, usually you hate the Jets and vice versa.
Like being in Chicago with the Cubs and Sox.
Yeah, yeah. If you're an Islander fan, you hate the Rangers, you know. But I kind of like, you know, I root for the Jets still, you know. But the first game I ever went to, I was about 9 years old, and a friend of mine's father, kid I went to grammar school with, his father owned the butcher shop, and he had season tickets to the Giants. And he took me to Bobby Lane and Charlie Connolly's last game at the Yankee Stadium.
And, oh, wow.
The quarterback was Bobby Lane on for the Steelers. And, you know, I was eight, nine years old, and that memory will always stick with me, you know, so I'll always be a Giant fan in some respect. But again, when the Jets came into town, I became a Jet fan. I formed, you know, to make it. And I ended up in the bar in Queens, not too far from Shea Stadium. I opened up 1979 a big joint in Queens, not too far from Shea. So I became a Met fan as well. And I was never a Yankee fan because growing up in the Bronx, maybe less than 2 miles from Yankee Stadium, all my friends were Yankee fans. And I was a Giant fan because Willie Mays and the Giants were still in New York when I was a kid. And so they used to break my chops mercilessly. You know, they used to break my chops. And consequently, I hated the Yankees when I was a kid. I just hated the Yankees. And yet we had on our podcast, we had the ultimate Roger Maris.
Andy Strasburg.
And I got to, Frank gave me a kick because he got to put up the picture that I was three rows behind the guy who caught Roger Maris' 61st home run when I was 12 years old. And this guy was flabbergasted because he's a Roger Maris aficionado, you know. And here Frank flashes the picture. By the way, there was one guy in the stadium that day you might recognize. And so, I mean, I've always been a sports nut.
Yeah.
Yeah, and well, I also may add that Billy wrote one book without me. It was Confessions of a Bronx Bookie because he was an illegal bookmaker in New York. So his fandom only goes so far. His fandom is whether he won or lost the bet that day.
Yeah.
I became a green fan real quick, and I don't mean the Jets either. I mean green.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because in with your book, there's that gambling plays a huge role. Gambling is kind of the main theme throughout the book.
You think?
Yeah.
You think?
Yeah. And I'll be honest with you. For me, I mean, you know, nowadays we live in a world where everything's legal. I mean, the Cardinals, you know, they've got their opening, you know, they're going to be the first team to actually allow actual betting in the stadium. But back in the 60s, back in the 50s and 60s, gambling was a four-letter word in sports. And so with Rosenblum, he was a gambler. We all know that. So how much do we know? How much do we don't know? How much don't we know about him as a gambler?
Well, it's more than just him. And I'll really go on and tell about all of the other owners and their involvement in gambling. Go ahead, Billy.
Yeah, well, actually, you know, think about it. In the 50s when the NFL was started, there was no money in the NFL. And, you know, NFL wasn't really a big deal in the 50s. When I was a kid growing up, baseball was the number one sport. That was it. Second was boxing. Everybody knew who the heavyweight champ was. Everybody knew who the lightweight champ was, middleweight champ, light heavyweight champ. Boxing was then maybe college football. NFL was a poor fourth, maybe. So anybody getting into the NFL had to be more than an entrepreneur. Number one, they had to have deep pockets. But number two, they had to be a gambler. And if you look at Art Rooney owns racetracks, and there's many stories about him actually hitting a 6-horse parlay and rotating from one, just dumping the money from one race to another, hit 6 in a row, and that's how he bought the Steelers. All of them, Modell, huge gambler with connections. They were a little, you know, like as they say in the old neighborhood, a little fugazi.
Yeah.
they all had a lot of fugazi connections. And a lot of that money was cleaned up. I always remember a great line that Pacino said in The Godfather. When he was talking to one of the family, he said, we're cleaning up the business. We're going into more legitimate businesses now. You know, we're cleaning up the money. And what more legitimate business to go into than one they already knew about? If they were bookmakers or if they were gamblers, and a lot of them owned tote machines and slot machines. What more legitimate business to go into that they would know about than professional football?
Yeah, Rooney owned the Steelers and he owned a racetrack. Tim Mara was a big gambler. They're all well known.
Odell, yeah. Odell.
And even the Bidwells out here in Chicago had the racetracks.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. They were all gamblers. That's what gets me. I mean, Pete Rose Hall of Fame right now because, you know, they found out he was gambling on baseball. Now, he swears he never bet on the Reds. Maybe he's telling the truth. Maybe he did. Maybe he didn't. But as a gambler, as a compulsive gambler, which I was before I became a bookmaker, because that's what drove me to bookmaking. I was just tired of paying my paycheck over, signing it over every week the bookies, because I had to do a lot of bookies. And I was paying them all. I said, you know what? I'm going to get on the right side of this. But if he didn't bet on Cincinnati, I'd be surprised. I mean, if I had inside information and I was a gambler, I'd use it. Now, as we point out in the book, Roselle came down hard on the players that gamble. He came down hard on
Harris and Horning.
Yeah, Horning and Alex Karras. But it's very difficult for a commissioner to come down hard on his boss. You know, if it's the guy paying your paycheck and he's crooked or he's gambling, you blow the whistle on him because you lose your platform. That's it. You're done. You don't have the job no more. So
Bert Bell Upton told us Bert Bell used to have a phone in his house on Sundays that would ring anytime the line went a little sideways on a game, which would tip him off the game might have been fixed.
Oh wow! I did not know that.
Oh man.
Yeah, that's another thing. How in the world, and why in the world, do they have lines in the paper anyway? They show you the lines, they show you the injury reports, they show you the field conditions. Who is that to have any interest to other than a gambler? And like you said, in my day, when I was bookmaking, you know, we went to some lengths to stay clandestine. I mean, we put forward phones. Like, come Super Bowl, we rented a separate apartment and just put three dummy phones in the apartment we used all year and had them forwarded to the apartment across the hallway just in case we got busted. That's how scary it was. We didn't want to get busted. But now they advertise at halftime. I mean, you got sports betting sites advertising. Frank, am I wrong? They even have a commissioner now in charge of gamble.
NFL this year and instituted a director of legitimate gaming. Yeah. Gaming,
yeah. And now Las Vegas has a pro team.
Yeah, the CFL just opened up single game betting. And it's been interesting to hear people in the CFL talk about how gambling is going to save the league. Now, to me, and Scott and I have had this conversation, I've never seen the numbers how gambling is going to save a 9-team league. But with the NFL, it's completely different. I mean, you've got DraftKings, which is, yeah. You know, I'll tell you what, you know, every day I play fantasy, daily fantasy. I don't put $5 on fantasy football. I put $5 in the stock of the company. Because
it's
going to grow. You know, well, it's going to grow.
I mean, they're seeding. Right. That's exactly what they're doing.
It's only going to grow if Billy does not invest in it.
So, you know,
Frank, if I bought a cemetery, people would stop dying.
And it's so in reading the book, and Scott's probably the same way. It's like, you know, you're reading it, just everything that happened, and then looking in the 21st and 2021 and looking up and going, oh, there's another ad for DraftKings. It's like, we've come such a long way.
And FanDuel.
Yeah.
Well, H.L. Hunt says to Lamar in the book, he says, if this league is going to succeed, it's going to be because of gambling, not in spite of gambling. I mean, yeah, right now with this fantasy football and everything, they're seeding, you know, kids for the future. To gamble and to get involved in football. I mean, you know, it's like a heroin. A salesman going up to a kid in the street. Hey, the first one's for free. Don't worry about it. This one's on me. You know, they're seeding. You know, these kids, they're going to play with fantasy football. But later on, you know, we used to have these football tickets. The kids would bet $1 or $2 on, and they give them 10 to 1 on it. You know, the bookies used to hand out to their runners.
Right.
And that's all seeding. You know, get them involved. Get them watching football.
And I'm sure Carol Rosenblum is rolling over his grave somewhere, just looking down and going, what the hell? You know?
Yeah. Why couldn't I be getting a piece of this?
Yeah.
I mean, look at the outrage over Namath. $400,000 for 4 years in a Cadillac. The outrage. Nobody's worth that kind of money. Nobody.
Right.
Now, look at the money.
Carol foresaw all this coming.
Yeah.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Carol was a visionary. For everything you can say about him, you have to say he was a visionary and he saw everything coming.
Well, and just on the television part alone.
Yeah, I was just going to say, pay TV, he saw coming. He saw every aspect of it coming. He was a visionary, for sure. He was a genius in a lot of ways.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt.
Well, I know I worked in the newspaper business 30 years. And I was a sports editor. And, of course, every Saturday there would be a betting night for college football and the NFL. And Friday night, invariably, you get a bunch of calls from, you know, people asking what the lines were or whatever. And I used to always laugh because I was based in Birmingham, Alabama. That's where I'm from. And, of course, gambling publicly was a big no-no. But I'm thinking it's a big no-no, and yet every newspaper in the United States is running a gambling line.
Yeah.
Every day, you know, so there's something that doesn't quite match up there.
Yeah, and they did it on, and they, if you remember back on the NFL Today, back in the 70s, had Jimmy the Greek on.
Jimmy the Greek, Snyder, yeah, exactly.
So I'm going to ask you, if you were in Birmingham for 30 years, you must know my good friend Art Clarkson.
Oh God, I loved Art. Yeah, rest his soul. He was a great guy. We got to be pretty good friends there for a while. It was after he'd sold his interest in the in the Birmingham Bulls, but he was a super, super guy.
And a great salesman, because he had a gift of gab. We worked together in the Southern California Sun, and he was a season ticket holder. And then the second year, he went to Chicago, and that's how I got the job in Chicago. He asked me to come to Chicago to work with him with the Whippets. Art was a terrific fellow.
He was. You know, he's the one that brought minor league baseball back to Birmingham. And then he, after the WHA hockey team folded, he brought ECHL hockey to Birmingham. And when he promoted it, he said it was a combination of NASCAR and a street fight. And that's how he promoted the game. And he put a lot of people in the seats for, you know, basically double A hockey.
Yep. And also when he owned the Barons, he was the owner when Michael Jordan played baseball with him. And he also owned a baseball card company. And he said, if I ever need more money, all I'll do is crank out more Michael Jordan baseball cards and sell them, because they're the hottest things going. And he was really another guy who was ahead of his time. I miss him greatly.
Yeah, I do too. He was just sometimes during the summer when it would be slow, he would just call me when I was at work, and we talked for 2 hours. You know, he's completely lose track of time, just talking about the old WFL days and, you know, owning the Barons and hockey. But yeah, he was a visionary, and he did so much for the city of Birmingham and really every city he worked in.
Yep.
Right. Tell the guys again where they can get that book. Will you, Lamar's Gamble? Give them the three websites. We only gave them the one about a Make a Mook and a Mic. They can get it on a claim, right?
MakeAMookAndAMic.com. AmazonPress.com and Acclaim Press, ACCLAIME Press.com, and Amazon, of course. All three.
And you guys have, I mean, this is not your only book. You guys have another book out too. Tell us about that one.
Well, what did Frank tell you about that?
It's called If These Lips Could Talk. And it's loosely, well, it's based on my career in show business. I've done 700 shows, produced 4 movies, and I got the name from a good friend of mine, Marty Nedboy, who would also say, if I ever do a biography, I'm going to call it If These Talk. So I stole the title from him. And it's basically recollections of my life and career with people like Brooke Shields, people like Candace Bergen, people like John Wayne, Frank Sinatra, Don Rickles, It's a really, really, really fun book, I think. Stallone, I think it's a fun book, and I try to give some insight into how much luck it takes, how to survive in the business, how other people make their way in the business on the crew. I think Billy and I are pretty proud of that book.
And when you mentioned Rickles, I smiled, because like every other night, I usually need a laugh. My day job, I'm a court officer, so I deal with a lot of bad news. But, you know, nothing cheers me up than turning on YouTube, and I'm like, let's do Rickles, Carson. And what was Rickles like? Was he as genuine and as sweet and nice as I've been told?
I think that Don Rickles was probably the nicest man I ever met. Don and I really became close friends. As a matter of fact, we would go on vacations Don and Barbara. My wife Karen and I would go on vacations with Don and Barbara. Well, vacations for me and Karen, when Don was working in Montreal, we went up to Montreal. When Don was working in Chicago, we went to Chicago. We would go down on Rush Street after the show for dinner. And there was always an old Irish cop that would come by the table and walk Don back to the hotel to keep all the all of his fans away. And I've got such fond recollections of Don. Tony O, who was Frank Sinatra's road manager, also took over Don's career after Frank passed. And we've stayed very close with Tony O. And like Billy said, he'll come on the podcast again at the end of September. But, you know, Don was a great guy. I mean, he was kind, he was generous. We went to his 70th birthday party. We went to every birthday party for 5 years. We went to his daughter's wedding. And we're just very honored that Don chose Karen and myself to be amongst his close circle of friends. Don would always say, for two guys to get along, really be friends, their wife has to get along famously. And Karen and Barbara got along famously.
That's a real good chapter, I think, and If These Lips Could Talk, because of Frank's close association with Don. The Rickles chapter is not only funny, it's insightful, and it's poignant. It was a fun book to help Frank write. It was just because of the, what was at stake? You know, the people that were in his immediate entourage, you know, the people that he hung out with.
Yeah, and we don't pull any punches because we take some shots at people that deserve having shots taken. Take them out. I tell real stories in a real way. Billy and I don't pull any punches when we have punches to throw.
And, you know, my father was a huge John Wayne fan. What was he like?
Well, my father was a huge John Wayne type two fan. And you'll have to read this.
Okay. Yeah, no, I read
the book. Good thing about the book is it's such an easy read because every chapter is self-contained. It's about a celebrity, but it has a beginning, a good lead. You're in the columnist business. You were Scott. You were an editor. So every chapter of the book has a good lead and a good kicker, and so it's an easy read. You know, maybe 8 pages of everybody in Frank's field. You know, the people that we're talking about. It's a good fast read. Good summer read, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm definitely going to order it. I mean, it sounds fascinating. It's kind of funny too, because stories like these, some of them, I'm sure after you read it, they're going to be stories that you didn't want to hear, you know, if you like the person and find out they weren't really who you thought they were.
Well, there's some of that in there for sure.
If you're a Kathy Griffin fan, don't read the book.
Hey, Kathy, Oak Park's very own.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, and actually, funny you should mention her. It's been years and years ago. My wife and I were downtown Chicago, where we both work, and we were out actually over by the mall. And my wife's being Japanese, but you know, she recognized Kathy Griffin. Let's go say hi to her. I go, no, let's leave her be. Leave her be. And she would just shop, and it's funny you should mention her, because it's like, yeah, it's like somebody, she's from Oak Park, no big, you know, friends of friends know, you know, who Kathy Griffin is still around here. Billy, and we're approaching here, and we're going to segue, we're approaching 20 years of 9/11.
Yeah.
And I know you were there on the day it happened. And, you know, for me, I was in D.C. on 9/11, saw the aftermath of the Pentagon, and I know you were a first responder. With everything that's been going on, especially the last 4 years and the last year, you know, people, I have this conversation, the closer we get, you know, talking about sports, you know, where sports and real and history collide. And I know with 9/11, the NFL, they canceled everything. But for you as a first responder, is with 9/11 coming up, and after everything you've seen, and everything you've been through also in Vietnam, how do you, at times with everything that's going on, for you, is it like, is sports for you like it is with me? Because I spent a year in Iraq And so for me, sports has always been kind of the one thing that I turn to know it's going to bring us all together and at least going to put a smile on our face for a few hours.
You know, obviously, 9/11 was absolutely horrific. I mean, the year I spent in Nam was one thing, and I had probably a different experience than most at Nam because I wasn't a combat officer. I was in the Air Force, and I saw my share of coffins getting loaded on C-130s, but I just wasn't a ground pounder. And to this day, whenever I see a Marine or a ground pounder, I bow my head in reverence because I understand what they went through over there. 9/11 was an absolutely horrific day, and firemen are a lot like military guys, and I guess a lot like locker room guys in sports, is that we have this tight connection, you know, the brothers. We call each other the brothers for a reason. I mean, you live, sleep, and eat with each other, and you depend on each other to cover each other's back. So consequently, when anything happens to any of the brothers, it weighs heavy on all of us, you know? Like I said, it was a terrible day. But as you said, how sports bring us together. It's interesting to me working at the dig. And let me just correct you. I wasn't there when the buildings collapsed. I had already retired, but I went up there 2 days after, of course, because everybody went to the dig. I knew guys that died. They were friends of mine. And some friends of mine, their sons were buried in that rubble. And the one thing about that dig was the way it brought the country together, you know, left, right, Democrat, Republican. Everybody was there. Everybody wanted to help. Guys from Canada, firemen from Canada, firemen from all over the country came up there to help. You know, I saw dowagers. I saw people with, you know, with mink coats on making sandwiches and handing it out to iron workers. The iron workers' contribution to the dig is immeasurable. We couldn't do nothing without those guys. And they didn't accolades, or they walked off jobs that they were getting paid for to go down there and cut metal at the dig, you know. So as horrific as it was, and of course it always weighs heavy on us, like I said, we firemen, we hang out together. We go to golf outings, we go to trips, we go hang gliding, any kind of thing that you can think of, skiing, we do it together. And excuse me, Frank and I collaborated on our next book, which is about 9/11. Well, at least the final four chapters are about 9/11 anyway, called Combustible. And in doing research for that book, when I was together with these guys, I'd always say to them, look, man, I know you were there. I know you were at 9/11. I know you were there. I don't want to know what you remember about 9/11. Tell me one thing that you absolutely cannot forget. And this is 20 years later. And you know, guys 70, 65 years old put their eyes in their hands and just start weeping. Yeah. And look up at me and say, Billy, the smells. I can't forget the smells. Because we have a euphemism in the department, especially in the busy houses, because we come across a lot of victims in the busy houses. You know, I always worked in the South Bronx and Harlem, and that's where the guys are that like the juice. They like the action. And we'd come across a burnt body, and you don't call a body a burnt body because I don't know if you've ever felt burnt flesh, but it's very difficult to believe that man is the highest order of things when you do. It's a smell that never leaves you. It's a disgusting smell, burnt flesh. So we call them roasts. I got a roast. I got two roasts. And that euphemism, applies. Well, down there at the dig, every fireman there has probably smelt a roast. But what we were smelling down there was flesh that had been rotting for 10, 12 days, 13 days and covered up. And it was almost like spoiled chicken. You know, you knew when you spread some of the rubble that you had something there because it would just jump back and reflexively. I mean, it wasn't like you did it because you smelled it. You're just like, whoa. And you knew that you had a body or a piece of a body. So, that day is going to be with me for a long, long time. And anybody who was down there is going to be with them for a long, long time. And I really, of the book we wrote, the next book we wrote, Combustible, we're both proud of those last five chapters, because I often think that, you know, I didn't want to dishonor the brothers, and I certainly didn't want to write I wanted to write about it as somebody who was there.
Yeah.
And I think we accomplished that. And so I'm really proud of those five chapters.
I can't wait to read it. When's the book coming out?
Let me give that to Frank.
Frank, you're muting.
It's going to be roughly the 1st of September.
Oh, okay. So perfect timing then.
Yep. So we're going to be busy promoting two books at the same time. But Lamar's Gamble, we can promote all the way through the Super Bowl, because I believe this. Well, I know the Super Bowl is in Los Angeles this week, so I think we're going to be really busy on Radio Row promoting the book during Super Bowl week for sure. So that's got a really long shelf life.
Yeah. Has anybody from the NFL reached out to you about the book?
Not yet.
We got the lawyers ready.
I'm hoping they don't.
You know what? Let me ask you. Has Dan Patrick reached out to you yet?
No, he hasn't. I represent Artis Gilmore.
Yeah.
And I represent Rod Carew for 40 years. So I've got some credibility with those guys, but I'm going to go after them sooner or later.
I watch Dan Patrick every, you know, he's usually my morning, especially now that, you know, the election's over. I mean, we're kind of in a calm period before the next election. So getting back to sports and laughing and everything, but I watch Dan Patrick pretty much every morning, but I would think he would want you to come and talk about the book on the show, because.
Well, you should call in Dan Patrick and say, you know, Dan, is really two guys that you should interview.
I tell you what, I'm going to make sure I tag him on the podcast for this one and see if maybe McLovin or one of the other guys picks up on it.
Well, I've got his phone number. I've got McLovin's phone number, so maybe drop him a note.
And pardon me?
I got Rich Eisen's phone number too.
Oh, I love watching him too. I don't mean to go all fanboy on some of these guys, but it's, you know, I've been sitting in my house for the last 18 months writing reports. So guys like Dan Patrick, you know, the podcast, Rich Eisen, have kind of helped me keep my sanity in some of those days, especially the winter months around here.
I'm very familiar with the winter months around there.
Oh yeah. How long were you in Chicago when you were with the Winds?
4 months.
Oh, okay. Right. You were with the Winds, not the Fire. That was the second season of the.
I was with the Winds, not the Fire.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think I was hired in April and we folded in September. So July. And I would say that I went to interview with the Cubs for a PR job, and I interviewed with Salty Stillwell, who was the general manager of the Cubs at the time. And the day I went, Rennie Stennett went 7-for-7, setting the major league record for most hits in a game. And it was that time that I decided I would get out of the sports business.
You know, just your experience with the World Football League. I mean, and Scott, you probably got more questions on this, because I hate saying this, I'm a little too young to really remember the World Football League by a couple years. But what was that like? First question, how long were you with the World Football League, and what was that experience like for you?
Well, I was with the World Football League for 2 years, almost since from the inception, almost to the time it folded. The Winds were dropped out of the league halfway through the second season. And that was when I terminated relationship with the Winds. But through that, I met Stu Barber, who is an offensive line coach, who was a great offensive lineman with the Buffalo Bills, who became general manager of the Buffalo Bills. And he introduced me to one of his friends, Steve Avazian, who became my godfather at Warner Brothers. So without the World Football League, I probably wouldn't have this career.
Oh, wow.
I was on the field the day Marty Schottenheimer became a coach, because Marty was trying to make it as a linebacker. And he went to Dick Corey, our coach after lunch, and he said, "Coach," he said, "Coach, I'm through." He said, "I don't have it anymore." He said, "Well, come back after lunch, and you're going to be my linebacker coach." So that's the day Marty became a coach.
Wow!
Become the seventh winningest coach in NFL history.
Well, I was there for opening night of the World Football League when the Birmingham Americans hosted Southern California. I was 13 years old, and of course, that was thrilling for me, being a kid in Birmingham, to have my own professional football team. But the one thing, Greg knows this, those magenta and orange uniforms were the greatest things I have ever seen since. God, I love those things. I have a Southern Cal, it's a replica, but I even have one of their magenta jerseys that I proudly display on occasion.
I'll tell you a quick Birmingham story. I was a PR director for this for the Winds, and after two exhibition games, Babe Parilli, our head coach, was fired. And he was replaced by Abe Gibron as our head coach.
Yep.
And we were going down for opening day of the 75 season. And they had the coin flip, and they asked me, "Well, which team do you want to introduce?" I said, "Well, I'll leave it up to the host." He said, "Well, we want to introduce our offense because we just signed Johnny Musso. And we want him to get a big, it's going to be a big hurrah in Alabama because he was a big University of Alabama star running back." So I went and told Abe, and I said, "We're going to introduce our defense. They're going to introduce their offense." And he said, "I don't want to introduce their offense. I don't want to introduce our defense. I want to introduce our offense." I said, "It's too late. That ship has sailed." He said, "I want to introduce our offense." And I said, "You can run anybody out on you on the field, but they're going to call the defense's name." So, so from that point on, Abe and I never really got along very well.
Well, I didn't know John Gilliam was a defensive tackle. That's different.
Exactly. Hey, I've never been to Chicago. I got to ask you all a question. I can tell you, like I said before, firemen, you know, we get together in groups, and out of my company, we used to run a bus trip to all ballparks, you know, or go to Fenway, go to Baltimore.
Yeah.
And to a man, they all loved Wrigley the most of any other field they were at. They all loved Wrigley Field. They said it was the best ballpark to see a game, the best ballpark to be at. But my question is about Chicago. Frank, is their pizza really better than us? Can it be better than New York pizza?
No, it's not. And as I'm going to say this also about Wrigley, under the stadium smells like piss.
Yeah. It smells like New Orleans.
Every place you go in that stadium smells like piss.
It's you know, with Wrigley, and I've only been to about five baseball stadiums. I've never been out east to Fenway or to Yankee or any of them. But for me, and I went there, my wife and I went there right after the Cubs won the World Series. So we went there the following April. And it was one of those days, it felt like autumn. Beautiful day, sun's out, sweatshirt weather, and we're in an empty stadium because getting the full tour. And it literally, it was a awe-inspiring moment, just being a sports fan. Wow. Because you're in the empty stadium and you're looking down and you're just thinking about all the people that played on there from, you know, starting, we'll start with Babe Ruth and work our way through. And then we went to the visitors locker room, which has really not changed. I mean, there's, you know, it's still the same one, or at least it was back then, that they'd been using for decades. And I'm sitting there and my wife's like, "What's wrong?" I go, "I can hear Ghost, and I could hear Lombardi. I could hear Unitas. I could hear all those guys in there." And then you're looking around going, "Holy crap, this is a small locker room. How did they fit everybody in here?" So if you make it out here, you've got to make that part of your trip is to Wrigley.
Yeah, because when I was there, you know, I produced a movie in 1991 called Babe Ruth and starred Stephen Lang as the Babe. And I was in Chicago, and the first thing I thought of was the called shot.
Yeah.
And there was some controversy about the called shot. And TV Guide asked me, "Well, what do you think about the controversy about the called shot?" And I said, "The movie's called Babe Ruth." He called the shot. When we do Charlie Root story, he won't have called the shot. But that's, you know, American folklore. You know what? You don't want to change American folklore.
No. And you know what? And there's actually been video. Isn't there video, like, possibly of him calling the shot? I mean, I always, when I talk, hear about it.
He's sort of waving towards center field, but I don't really know whether he called a shot or not.
I always, you know, like you, though, it's like, you know what? Yeah, he called the shot.
He certainly embraced the story after the fact.
Right.
He said he'd called a shot when it became a story. He saw a story, and then he embraced it for sure.
Yeah. Well, and, you know,
Muhammad Ali wasn't always rounds either, but he was close.
Yeah.
That's exactly. You'd love it. And talking about pizza, just doing the pizza route, I agree with you, Frank. The two pizzas, well, let's put it this way. I wouldn't say one's better than the other. It's like comparing apples to oranges. If you want a pizza casserole, then you go with Chicago deep dish.
Gotcha.
You know, and it's just, you know, because if you order deep dish pizza around here, you better have an hour to kill before it even gets to your table.
What I like about New York pizza is after you fold it, you pick it up. If everything slides off, I know I got good pizza.
Yeah.
Everything in the plate just slides off.
You're not going to get that with Chicago.
No. No, but you know, it's like anything else. As long as you got leftovers to bring home, you're good the next morning.
Now, I got to tell you, with the firemen going up to Wrigley, and they all love Wrigley, I think knowing firemen, that it might have had a lot to do with the bars outside Wrigley. Is there a special
street? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's the Wrigleyville, it's just bars. It's it is built up over the years, but it's pretty much what you've been told. Yeah, it's a lot of bars around Wrigley. It's
Waveland area, right? Waveland.
Pardon
area.
Me? Yeah.
Waveland Avenue. Yeah.
Yeah. And
so the wonder it smells like New Orleans.
Yeah.
And that's a great analogy, because New Orleans on a Sunday morning, those streets smell like beyond belief.
I was there. I've been there several times and with friends, and it's like, hey, what's that smell? I go, New Orleans. Ooh.
Well, I went there for 2 weeks and stayed 2.5 years. So I have a bit of an affinity towards New Orleans.
And when were you there? Were you there in the heat?
I got there at 71. My brother, who was a complete lunatic, Lord have mercy on him, he's dead now. But he could suck the oxygen out of a room. He was one of those guys. And he had sent me a letter when I was in New York, and he said, let me tell you something. You got to come down to this town. He says, the closest town to Europe that I found. And then he gave me the clincher. The clinching line in the letter was, the bars are open 24 hours a day. He said, they never close. And I says, I'm jumping on my fastest horse. I'm on my way. And that was it. And I went down to New Orleans for 2 weeks, and then I started attending bar, and it was just a great town. And again, since Scott's from Alabama, I got to tell you, I was attending bar at Pat O'Brien's, which was the busiest joint in town. And come weekends, when Alabama was playing LSU, and all those girls blew into town, and I had a place in the French Quarter. Man, it was great to be alive, be 23. And the New York accent didn't hurt all. It didn't hurt much, I tell you that. And then there was the same thing with Mississippi. You know, Ole Miss was playing LSU, and man, all those girls would come down. And of course, they weren't coming down for the games. When they went to New Orleans, they went for the weekend, and it was party central. And it was just a great time to be alive.
Yeah, you know, football was my gateway to New Orleans, because the first time I'd ever been to New Orleans was for the Florida State Auburn game in the Sugar Bowl, and we stayed there, you know, 4 or 5 days, and I realized pretty quickly New Orleans was a place I wouldn't mind visiting every now and then.
He's got a question. Auburn or Alabama fan?
I went to the University of Alabama at Birmingham, so I'm a UAB Blazer fan. When I grew up, before UAB got a team, I was an Alabama fan. But my dad, Billy, kind of reminded me of my dad, because in the state of Alabama back in the day, you were either an Alabama or an Auburn fan. My dad rooted for both of them. And when it got to the game where they played at the end of the year, he cheered for the team that had the best chance to finish higher in the rankings. So he was kind of Switzerland when it came to that rivalry.
And and the great thing about New Orleans too, and you know, we're talking about, you know, the nightlife and everything, is just the food.
The food is amazing. I and nobody And I've been fortunate enough to be, I've spread my wings pretty far in this world. Nobody does the seafood, but they do in New Orleans. Oh, it's just unique. I mean, they just, the etouffee and the grilled oysters. It's just, I mean, I go back every couple of years because, a lot of my heart's in New Orleans.
And you have to probably have to let your belt out a few times after you get back.
Just let me interject. I'd like to interject something just so the listeners don't think Billy is a complete degenerate. He was a degenerate gambler. He was a degenerate alcoholic. He was a degenerate drug addict. He was also a New York City firefighter. At 58 years old, he decided to put the plug in a jug, went back to school at the University of Florida. At 62, got his degree in journalism, and has been writing and doing stand-up comedy ever since. So I take my hat off to my partner, William.
I salute you. I know you're Air Force and I'm Navy, but as a fellow vet, I salute you on that. And
brother, thanks for your service in Iraq. It couldn't have been no picnic.
Well, you know what? I think, you and I both know it's, when you're in a combat zone, you got to find the humor. Otherwise, and as a firefighter, you know that very well. You've got to find the humor. Otherwise, you're going nuts real quick.
Without a doubt. You got to find the humor, and you got to, especially in a combat zone. My first book, Confessions of a Bronx Bookie, is kind of autobiographical. And I'm proud of the three chapters I wrote about Nam too. Like Frank said, my fellow Irishman, I was born in County Cork, Ireland, my fellow Irishman said it the best, Oscar Wilde. He said, the only thing I can't resist is temptation. That's the way my life was.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, on that note, we will end here. And Scott and I both appreciate you coming on and talking the book and everything else under the sun with you. Before we let you go, we talked about where you can find the books, but where can we find you guys on social media?
www.amicandamike.com and MIC for Mike. It's got all of our podcasts. It's got all of our blogs. It's got all of our books. You can buy all four of our books on the site. If you want to get an autograph, that's how you again, it's amicandamike.com, and it's at acclaimpress.com or Amazon, and just put in the name of the book that you want to find, Lamar's Gamble, or If These Lips Could Talk, or soon, Combustible, and you'll find it.
All right. And Billy, where can we find? Can we find you on Twitter?
Yeah, I'm on the Bronx Billy O.
Twitter. Okay. All right.
Bronx Billy O on Twitter. I think that's my tag on Instagram too. I don't use it a lot, but I want to leave you guys, Scott and Greg. First of all, thanks for having us on, and really been an entertaining chat with you guys. And I'll leave you as a broken down old gambler, what they used to tell Vegas the few times that I win. Tell them where you got it. So let them know where they can find us if they want to interview us. We're trying to push the book. We think it's a good read. We want to get it out there.
Well, we will.
It's a great read.
It is an awesome read. And we will definitely, and I always do this after every podcast, I let everybody on Twitter know where to find our guests. And hopefully you're going to be getting a few calls from Canada soon, which a good portion of our audience is up north. And I know everybody in Canada will enjoy reading this book, because Scott and I always say, American football history is also Canadian football history, with so many, a lot of Americans play up there and vice versa. So it's mutual. So gentlemen, thank you very much. And for everybody listening, we will see you again soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
The coveted AFC Championship Trophy is named for a man who many consider among the founders of professional football. Lamar Hunt was born in Arkansas, reared in Dallas, Texas. He wanted nothing more than to bring and own a professional football team to Dallas, so he applied to the NFL for a franchise expansion but got turned down. In 59, he and fellow business partners decided to form an entire new league called the American Football League. He then became owner of the Dallas Texans. The National Football League wanted to be in Dallas too, bringing the Dallas Cowboys, which split the fan base. So, in 1963, Hunt started hunting for a new home for his team. Kansas City Mayor H. Roe Bartle, also known as Chief, promised home attendance of at least 25,000 a game. Hunt agreed to move to Kansas City, and the Dallas Texans became the Kansas City Chiefs, named after Roe Bartle. In 66, the Chiefs won their first AFL championship and reached the first ever Super Bowl, known back then as the AFL-NFL championship game. They lost to the Green Bay Packers. Later in 66, the NFL and AFL agreed to merge with a championship game between the two leagues at the end of the season. Well, Hunt had jokingly called it the Super Bowl. By the third championship game, the term Super Bowl had stuck. It became official. Hunt had other major league influences, too, on Kansas City. He founded Major League Soccer. He owned the Kansas City Wizards and other sports franchises. And he also helped establish the Worlds of Fun and Oceans of Fun theme parks. Now, just south of those theme parks is the Hunt-developed Subtropolis. It's 5.5 million square feet, a 110-acre man-made limestone cave. It's still considered the world's largest underground business complex, and a lot of it runs under Worlds of Fun. Hunt was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 72. In the 84-85 season, the NFL established the Lamar Hunt Trophy for the AFC Championship winner, and today, Chiefs players still have an L and an H on their AFC patch on their uniforms. Now, the Chiefs have a chance to bring that trophy home, the trophy named for their beloved founder, Lamar Hunt.
This is Elroy Hirsch of the Los Angeles Rams presenting the Rams Song.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.